For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
All right, welcome everyone. Good evening. Okay, so I first apologize last week. I know we had some technical difficulties. I apologize about that. Okay, tonight's class is Marxism with its socialistic and communist applications of that as well, together with Judaism. We're hitting the turn of the century, going from the late 1800s into the 1900s, as we are hitting the controversies which are now going to encompass the century of the 1900s. This idea of Marxism in all of its different applications is really going to be the sweeping movement that is going to be at odds with Judaism. As I put on the front of our notes, like, well, why is this in our coursework? What are we learning about Marxism for? Well, it's because there were hundreds of thousands of Jews who joined the ranks of the socialist movement, of the communist movement, of the Marxist movement, during the late part of the 1800s and early part of the 1900s. So aside for the fact that it was the greatest threat to Judaism at the time, which it was, it spawned a new element of the secular Jew who was socialist in nature. And it's significant to be aware of that because, as we'll see, the impact that it continues to have today, and in understanding what for ourselves what Judaism is as we contrast it to what Marx believed life was about, the idea of pursuing utopia, the idea of pursuing the perfect world. Judaism and Marx both pursued the perfect world. They both wanted it to be that perfection, that utopia. It's just Marx is going to teach us what happens when you pursue that without the structure of the law that we have. When you take the ideal and you try to create it without the balance of all that we have. So as we go through this, I think it'll be very strengthening for ourselves, and it'll be helpful to understand what we're dealing with in the world around us today. But just as a word of introduction, I have a quote here from the scholar Edmund Wilson, who is not Jewish, but he wrote a book on the history of socialism, and I open up our class tonight with a quote from him. The characteristic genius of the Jew has been especially his moral genius. That's always been the characteristic of the Jew. Morality, that which is correct, that which is right. Therefore, he concludes, does Edmund Wilson, that nobody but a Jew, meaning Marx, Karl Marx himself, could have fought so uncompromisingly and obstinately for the victory of the dispossessed classes. It has to have been a Jew. Who else would have taken on a life's mission to bring the worker who has always been exploited and underpaid and overworked? Who else other than a Jew, he writes, would be the one to take that up as his life mission? Now, these utopian movements, socialism and communism, we're not really going to discuss at length. It's really impossible. As I was preparing for this, the branches of what come out of Karl Marx and his philosophy is so enormous. And over the 100 years, 150 years since he began espousing these ideas, it's broken off into so many different ways that it's impossible to really get a good handle on it without an entire lecture series on that, which we're not going to do tonight. That's not quite in the purview of what we want to accomplish here. But they all have this utopian element, and that has tremendous Jewish influence. It's a Jewish idea, and it's born out of, as we'll see, Jewish concepts throughout the Torah, except it's without the Jewish means. And it literally sweeps hundreds of thousands of Jews into the fervor, as I mentioned, 1800s and 1900s. And lastly, why are we studying this tonight? Because it's impossible to understand what's going on in the land of Israel today without understanding the socialist background of the early Zionists who settled the land, who created the land, and who built a socialist culture. And as all things take time to play themselves out and then make adaptments and adjustments, it's literally what we're watching happen now overseas in our homeland. But it was built on socialist principles. So to understand where we're coming from and what we're dealing with today and where we're going, one has to really understand the backdrop of hopefully what we'll cover tonight. Okay, let's get started. Historical context and background. So the 1800s for the Jews is, as you know, of course. Thank you very much. This is, if nothing else, you know that I'm going to conclude my sentence with the worst century for the Jewish people. So it actually wasn't the worst. That much I'll admit. It was not the worst century for the Jewish people. We've done that already in the 1400s and the 1500s and the 1600s and the 1700s. It wasn't the worst, but it was pretty bad. It was pretty bad. But besides for the Jewish world, this late 1700s is famous for not the Jewish world, but for what happened in the world at large. And those are the two major revolutions which has forever changed the landscape in the world scene, which is the American Revolution here and the French Revolution in France. So those late 1700 revolutions changed and upended the natural order that had existed for a significant amount of time, and it spread the idea of liberty and freedom. The Napoleonic Wars, which followed shortly thereafter for the early part of the 1800s, then spread that idea throughout Europe. Eventually, he was, of course, defeated, and monarchies and empires reestablished themselves. And as the counter-revolution, so to speak, took hold again, we ended up back in a place of the revolution, the idea of the freedom and the liberty, and did it actually play itself out? In most of the empires that were reestablished, it did not. And it brought up the idea of Karl Marx, who's contemplating this concept, this idea of world history struggling with freedom and liberty, and the idea of the worker fighting back against the tyranny of the aristocratic class. Now, in the background of that, what's going on in the world, we have, of course, a Jewish problem, which has never gone away and never will until Mashiach comes. But the Jewish problem throughout the 19th century focuses a lot on Russia. The Jews, as we've been tracing their movements in this class from Babylonia in the 700s and 800s into the Iberian Peninsula and Spain, and then they get kicked out of there and they start moving east, and they move farther and farther east as they move all the way into Russia. Tsarist Russia was not a pleasant place. Not just not a pleasant place for the Jews, it just wasn't a pleasant place to be for anyone. But for Jews, it was particularly bad. There were waves of pogroms in the 19th century, throughout the 1800s. And in Tsarist Russia, the pogroms were sanctioned, or by wine. Let me just mention one thing as I was preparing for this class, so I'll just take a pause. So I use as my material for preparing several lectures from Rabbi Wein, as you know that I'm fond of doing. And just to share a small tidbit of divine intervention that I was blessed with, because that's what this class is going to be about. So I needed some other material to be able to prepare, and firm was coming in the parade, and last week was a little bit busy. And on Thursday last week, I happened to have seen on Sandra's desk in the office this book called 8 Questions People Ask About Judaism, written by Dennis Prager and Joseph Telushka, and it was just laying on the desk there. And I said, that's interesting. I wonder what the 8 questions are. It's an interesting topic. What are the big 8 questions? I'd like to know the answers, because if someone's going to ask me one of the big 8 questions and I don't have the answer, I'm going to be really embarrassed. So I pick up the book, and I open it up, just to like see, you know, to peruse the book, open in the middle to page 86, it happened to be in, and the title was Marxism and Communism. A true story. I said, no way. And what's it about? They go through, the two authors, Dennis Prager and Joseph Telushkin, go through comparing and contrasting what Judaism holds differently than Marxism and Communism, the ways it all, I'm like, this is just perfect. So a lot of the material comes from this lovely book as well. Anyways, so as I was mentioning, Rabbi Wein, when he talks about Tsarist Russia during this period of time, he actually quotes at length, I'm not going to do for you, pamphlets that the Russian government used to like drop off in towns saying, you should just know that all of the problems that exist here are the fault of the Jews. And they're the ones who are the landowners, and they're the ones who are the business owners, which wasn't always necessarily true, but that's what they wrote. And they said, and by the way, the police are going to be on a 3-day vacation from May 14th until May 17th. Nobody's going to be here. And they would literally incite and then pull everybody out regularly. And that's what it was like when you never knew when such things were going to happen. There was a draft where the Russian army would take through quotas into their army for a 25-year term of service, from which you basically didn't come back. And if you came back alive, you certainly didn't come back Jewish or religious, as you were converted, and then you were totally removed from everything. So it was a death sentence. And the way the Russian army used to do it is they used to come into the town, and they would demand a quota from the town. This town is responsible for whatever it would be. They literally, if it was like, we're so, we take for granted that we've been in this country ourselves for long enough that we think like the world is a pleasant place to be most of the time. But it was only 150 years ago that it would happen every year that the Russians would come in and they would say, oh, Beth Jacob, you have 450 members, I need 25 children on May 1st. And Young Israel, you have whatever it's 200 members, I need 15 children. You come, you pick, you choose. 25, 15, I need them. And how do you choose? Who chooses? Who chooses which children are taken to be conscripted for a 25-year death sentence? This is real life. This isn't the Hunger Games. This is what happened. And somebody had to choose the death sentence for the child who was sent. I can tell you it was not a fair system. That much I can tell you. The wealthy children did not go. The rabbi's children generally did not go. The business owner's children did not go. The poor, the orphans, those who didn't have anything did. And it was a miserable system, and it caused tremendous resentment. Because why does my child go? And why doesn't your child have to go? And there was no real good answer for that. But the system was created by the czars that there was very little to be done, but it wasn't fair. That much. No one is going to sugarcoat what it was like in Tsarist Russia to say it was a fair and pleasant. Some rabbanim made a lottery, but that was more the exception than the rule. It was more the exception than the rule. And that was the backdrop of what life was like. So if you were a Jew living in Russia, as about 5 million were, your feelings towards government were generally not rosy. Because government was evil. It was. The Russian government was evil towards the Jews, and you had very little good to say about it. The Russians forced all the Jews to live in the Pale of Settlement. They had a swath of land in between the Baltic Sea and the Black Sea, which was not particularly fertile. And that's where all the Jews had to live. You had borders. Jews could live here, not there. There were towns that you could live in. And sometimes they would change, and all the Jews had to move from here to there. 40% unemployment rate. Infant mortality was 1 in 5. You knew, living as a Russian Jew, you were born into an environment in which you knew 1 in 5, like how attached did you get? 1 in 5 didn't make it. 1 in 5. 40% unemployment rate is unfathomable. So 20% of the population was always on some type of a gemach. Everyone was trying to figure it out. It was not a pleasant life. Rabbi Wine, when he talks about this period, describes many of the things which we look at fondly today, terms and concepts, were really made up jobs that people did just so they should be busy. Like a shadchan. Not a real job. But when everybody's unemployed, so somebody became a shadchan. Or a badchan at a wedding, which we don't have so much today, but there are people who do make jokes and juggle and do things. There was a badchan. A gabbai. A gabbai was a job. You were the gabbai of the shul. Because you didn't have another job. So they created, in this environment, many of the things which they like there's just like a role, but no one really has a job, but there were actual jobs to do all of these things, which were not real jobs, just for the sake of having a job. But this was the environment. This was the environment of the Jewish world, particularly in Russia, and the rest of Europe wasn't all that much better in many of the areas. And now the Enlightenment hits. So we have all of these things this is what's going on in the 1800s. You have Russia, which was a miserable existence for the Jews. You have in Western Europe, which has been discussed with the Enlightenment and German and Reform movement. All of these things are taking place. Now when the Enlightenment really sweeps through Europe, breaking down a lot of the ghettos and bringing in different modes of thought, there were three basic approaches that we've learned already, two of the three, that the Jewish world takes to addressing the world that they found themselves in. One, which we've discussed at length, is the Hasidim and the Musar movement. The Hasidim and the Musar movement, which was from the Yeshiva movement, the idea of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, and personal growth and improvement and ethical development. The goal of these movements was to create a better Jew. The Jews are suffering, but the solution is, make a better Jew. Get the Jew to be alive with passion, whether it be through the Hasidic movement, through the love, through the joy, through the dance, through the prayer. But it was, let's reinvigorate, reinfuse life into the Jew through the Musar movement and ethical development. If we make a better Jew, will solve the problem that the Jewish people are having. But we need to become better. That was one whole approach. We've discussed that at length. The other approach, which has been the last two classes that we've had, has been the Haskalah, the Enlightened Movement, and the Reform Movement that we've been discussed over the last 2 weeks. And that was, create a new Jew. We don't need a better Jew. The Hasidim were making ourselves more insular, more pious, more religious, and by being a better Jew, we'll have better luck, so to speak, quote-unquote, in the world around us. But we need to be better. The Haskalah, the Reform Movement, took two approaches to say, no. You see, we have a problem. Clearly, this has not been working out for us. What we need is a new Jew. We need to shed the old Jew and reform Judaism. We need to make it somewhat different, somewhere more embracing of the world around us. And if we could get rid of that outdated culture and worldview and become more aristocratic, more cultured, we'll be accepted by society. Those movements of the Haskalah Reform wanted to be Jewish. They were Jewish movements. It was just reforming, as the name implies, what Judaism is, so that it could adapt better to the world around us. Those are what we've been studying for the last 2 weeks, and the, so to speak, Jewish controversies that were created through them. Tonight, we have a new approach. Marxism is not either one of those two. It's a universal approach. It says we need to create a new society. It's not that the Jew is the problem. These first two approaches are dealing with we're the problem, which is a very common victim mentality. It's me. I'm being abused. I'm being oppressed. I'm the problem. I need to fix something. So the Hasidim turned internally. We're going to make ourselves better Jews. The Reform Movement said we need to make ourselves into different types of Jews. So, but that's all we need to change. Marxist, that movement said, it's not the Jewish problem. We need to change the world. The world is broken. If we fix society as a whole, then automatically what's going to happen is that the Jewish problem will be solved as well. The idea that when high tide comes in, all the boats rise up. In a high, so if we could bring the waters of the world up, so then we'll solve the Jewish problem. Now again, Marx wasn't interested in the Jewish problem. I'm talking about why Jews bought into this program. Marx wasn't trying to solve the Jewish problem at all. He hated the Jews, as we'll see. He wrote a book called The World Without the Jews. He was not interested in fixing the Jewish problem. Or he was, actually, but the problem that he was interested in fixing isn't the way that we would look at the Jewish problem of persecution. He would look at the problem as all that we've affected the world with. But that's a separate discussion. But in any case, we need to rid the world of the aristocracy, exploitation, class struggle, nationalism, bigotry, persecution. If the world is rid of those entities, there's no longer an exploitation of the working class. There's no longer a class struggle. There's no longer nationalism or bigotry. So then we don't have a problem anymore either. And we get swept up. That's a universal approach. It's not at all Jewish. It's anti-religious. But it is immensely popular amongst the Jews. Why? Right? Because it works. It's also very anti-government. Actively revolutionizing against government. And if you're a Jew, particularly a Jew living in Russia where Marxism is going to catch on strongest, you're also anti-government. And now you have a movement that's all about getting rid of this oppressive government. For what purpose? To make a better life. To make a fair life. A safe life. So in theory, it's very good. Not only is it very good, but it's very Jewish, as we're going to see. The principles that underlie what Marx wanted to create are, many of them, very Jewish. The methods that he's going to go about them are, we're going to see, is where there's a variation, which is why it's important for us to study, because when we talk about these great controversies, a great controversy, even though there's not going to be like a real juicy controversy like the Emden Eibishitz, where like two people fighting, but here you have a movement that has a nugget of Judaism in it, a goal that's very similar to our goals that we all have and want, but when the means are very different. So we have the ability to look back 150 years from the time that it was introduced to the world and say, well, did it work? So we can look back and say that. But we're going to be fighting ourselves today, tomorrow, in the next 5-10 years, some other movement that's going to promise utopia in some other form, stripping it of its Jewish means of getting there. And this is the type of, like, we have historical precedent as to what happens when we try that. Okay, let's get into this a little bit. What we're going to do tonight is I want to discuss some of the principles in which Marxism differs greatly from where it's aligned and where it's different. and then use those to show what ended up happening in the beginning of the Zionist movement and where that leaves us today. So let's get started. I'm on page 2, letter D, Marxism. Here we go. Let me just switch so I have the same thing that you do. Okay, Karl Marx. You see, mid-1800s, he dies in 1883. He was a German philosopher, he was an economist, he was a sociologist, he was a historian, he was a journalist, and he was a revolutionary socialist. In short, one of the most influential figures of our modern era. That is pretty much undisputed, what he's done in the world, what he created, is undeniable in terms of the impact that he had. Of course, he was Jewish. His grandparents were observant Jews. His parents already left the fold and converted to Christianity. But that doesn't change the fact that he was born Jewish. He never saw himself as Jewish, but he could never shake his identity. He was always identified as a Jew, even though he himself never held himself to be a Jew, and he was a rabid anti-Semite. He hated the Jews, as I have mentioned, and we'll get to some of that other things as well. I don't want to spend too much time going through his whole theory, which is much larger than we can cover. So what I did is I just took from Wikipedia this little box. We'll go through this and use that as a way of discussing the basic premises of his approach, and then we'll use that to contrast that in letter E to the differences between that and Judaism. So let's just read the two together and use that as a springboard in a shortened way to understand what it is that he held. Marxist theories about society, economics, and politics. I'm just going to stop there right away. What many people like to point out, if you do any research on Marxism, is that his was an all-encompassing theory that wasn't just politics, it wasn't just society, and it wasn't just economics. He had a world view that encompassed all of them. That society, politics, economics, they all stem, it's all one unified whole, which also, by the way, makes it very similar to Judaism in that it's not just like a theory here or there. It was a world view that encompasses everything that can happen. It all is explained and understood in this theory. And this idea, collectively known as Marxism, holds that human societies progress through class struggle. That throughout world history, there's a progression that the human race is going through, that it's an inevitable progression. There's nothing that anyone can do to change it. It starts with hunter-man in the beginnings of time, beginning developing societies, and then as societies develop, beginning commerce, as commerce is beginning capitalism, eventually capitalism will give way to socialism and communism, but there's a progression that the human being and the human race is going through, similar to the development of a child. As a child, there's a process that the child goes through. First, the child learns to babble, and then it learns to eat a little bit, and then it learns to crawl, and then it learns to walk, and then it learns to... All the things that a child does as it progresses until it reaches maturity. So Marx believed the human race was going through that process. And the end of the process was going to be this classless, nationless society in which people worked for the sake of working and everybody had what they needed and was provided for, but it was a progression and it was, you couldn't stop it. There's nothing a human can do to stop or arrest the development of society. And that struggle that's going to push us forward, he wrote, was a conflict between an ownership class that controls production and a dispossessed laboring class that provides the labor for production. And that's the battle. Those who own the factories and those who are working in the factories. And he called capitalism the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, believing it to be run by the wealthy classes for their own benefit. And he predicted that, like previous socioeconomic systems, capitalism produced internal tension, which would lead to its self-destruction and replacement by a new system called socialism. Meaning capitalism would run its course. It needs to. Here's where production meets it's gonna, people will own things, they'll force people to work, they're gonna get more out of them than really what they're paying them. And eventually that will collapse on its head. But the ideas of capitalism will then flower into socialism in which everyone takes, not me owning you or your work and I become wealthy, but we all work together and we all become wealthy. That's a simplistic overview. We'll get to some more things in a moment. He argued that class antagonisms under capitalism between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat would eventuate in the working class's conquest of political power in the form of dictatorship of the proletariat, and eventually establish a classless society, socialism or communism, a society governed by the free association of producers. The way that socialism and communism, by the way, is defined, there's a catchphrase that they use in the socialist or communist movements, that everybody contributes according to their ability and takes according to their... depends on how you conclude that. So the socialist movement would conclude that phrase with takes according to their work. And the communists conclude that with according to their needs. So that communism is viewed as a higher form of socialism. First you hit socialism, in which everybody contributes according to their abilities, and then you get back according to what you contributed. So it's not completely even. That's more socialist. And then that progresses, once the world is used to that concept, then it progresses to the higher form, which is communism, which is everybody gets according to their needs, so that I don't actually even get according to what I'm putting in, but I'm happy with that because I got what I need, and I'm happy that you got what you needed. That's a higher form of this Marxist ideal than socialism. But we're not, again, spending much time on that anyway. Okay, the last argument is that he believed that not only is it inevitable, socialism and communism, but Marx actively fought for their implementation in arguing that social theorists and underprivileged people should carry out organized revolutionary action to topple capitalism and bring about socioeconomic change. And not only is it inevitable, but that it needs to be helped along. You should help society move that way, of the underclass, the workers who are being exploited, should revolt and have a revolution against the upper class, the aristocratic people who are forcing them to work and exploiting them, to help society along its goal to achieve utopia. Okay. Now, again, as I said, as we go through letter E, some of the differences between Marxism and Judaism. If you were a Jew and you heard about these ideas about ending exploitation, ending class struggle, ending nationalism, bigotry and persecution, you would be all over it. Because it sounds good. And compared to the alternative, sounds really good. So as these ideas begin to percolate throughout Russia and Europe, all of Europe, and it spreads, the youth, the Jewish youth, who have been... this is the story of the Jewish people. Like every movement, this is what happens. When we're in America now, so we have different struggles. It's so hard for us to appreciate that the biggest struggle for a yeshiva bachar in 1890s, 1910, Russia, were secret communist meetings and secret communist pamphlets that somebody snuck into the yeshiva. And that's what you were fighting. That's what you were worried about. You were worried about your child when he closed his door at night and you weren't sure what he was reading, that he was reading communist propaganda. Because that's what was happening. And we were losing the youth by the hundreds of thousands. We're gonna see at the end of the class that the labor unions here in America were founded almost all by American socialist Jews, who almost all of them were the upper class of the yeshiva world back in Europe, and were lost to the socialist movement and all of its fervor and its promise of a utopia, and are now names in American history, but no longer in Jewish history, not them nor their descendants. And that was the battle. And it's hard for us to put ourselves in that world, that's what you worried about when you sent your child off to yeshiva, that he would become a communist. But you did. That was the concern. So let's go through this. Let's go through letter E. I'm on page 2. Number 1, I have like 5 or 6 different points that will flesh out a lot of the different points I want to talk about with you tonight. Motivating aims. What's the goal? What's motivating Marxism? Number 1, they're very similar, Judaism and Marxism, in that they're both motivated by the desire to ultimately perfect the world and create a utopian society. It's beautiful. Let's have a perfect world. The Sakein Olam. We say it every day in Aleinu. To perfect the world, except we conclude with the Malchus Shakai, with God's kingdom. But the idea of perfecting the world is a Jewish idea. Marx also was very into. A utopian society was very appealing. The principles of fairness, equity, rights of the working man, that money is not the source of all power, that exploitation is considered evil, there should be universal brotherhood, peace. You're familiar with the passage in Isaiah, which we've quoted many times, but what are we going to do with our swords and our shields? We're going to beat them into plowshares. It's going to be peace. every man under his vineyard, the lion and the lamb, lying together. And here Karl Marx is saying that. We're going to do away with war, and we're going to do away with national boundaries, and we're going to do away with bigotry. So the concepts are all good. Concepts are even Jewish, except that's pretty much where the similarity is going to end. But it's dangerous because when you hear what the goal is, the goal sounds pretty noble. Except the way that we're going to get there and what exactly it's going to look like when we get there is going to be very un-Jewish. Highest being, what is the pinnacle of the on the food chain, so to speak, of you know the human world? What's the high? What's the highest point? So this is one of the most obvious and all-encompassing differences. For Jews, we all know what that is. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. We're a religion that believes God is one, and at the top of that food chain, so to speak, so God sits alone. And therefore, everything is under that dominion, and we'll see how all the ramifications of that, which we don't need to go into at great length tonight. But for Marx, that's not true. The highest being for man, he wrote, is man himself. That's a fundamental shift, which doesn't need to be, you know, couldn't be overstated, between man functioning in God's world and man functioning in a godless world in which man is himself God. Human self-consciousness, meaning our own thought process, our own self-consciousness, is the supreme divinity by the side of which none other shall be held. Now, if you hold man is supreme and there's nothing above man, then there's no source, obviously there's no room anywhere for religion in the world, which is why Marx was virulently and viciously anti-Semitic and anti-religious. It wasn't just against Jews, it was all religion. Which is why the famous quote, which you're all familiar with, religion is the opiate of the masses. And what did he mean by that? When a person was sick in his day, and he had a deathly illness, some type of death, or a terminal illness, and the doctors weren't able to treat it. So you give him an opiate, because what would the opiate do? It would simply mask the pain of the illness, so that you would be able to go about doing your business and not worry about the pain, even though the illness that you have is going to kill you soon. But at least you shouldn't feel it. So what Marx meant is, you're sick, society is sick, and it needs to be fixed. It needs a revolution to completely change it. But as long as man has religion, it's masked. There's a little bit of a painkiller in which he'll say, I have my belief and it's God's will. So as long as I have that, you'll never realize how ill you are, and therefore the masses will never arise to rebel against those who are oppressing them, because when they go back to their home and have their miserable existence, what they'll say is, God's will for now. Therefore, Marx said, you have to obliterate a religion to allow the suffering working class to see and feel the pain of how miserable their life is, so that they would rebel against those that are causing that. That's why he wrote a book called The World Without the Jews, that all the world's problems come from the Jews and the Jews' belief, but because of the fact that there is no higher being, so therefore man is the highest pinnacle, and we have to remove the things that are preventing man from seeing his problems, i.e. religion. So religion has no place whatsoever in a Marx worldview. Now, what that also allows for when you don't have a divine being is in the area of morality, you have no bearing, you have no moorings. For Marx, without any divine dictum, all revolutionary behavior is morally justified. If you have to kill some king or his governor, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing to feel guilty about, because society has to progress from where it is now, in which the working class is oppressed and exploited, to a point in which that working class rebels against that aristocratic ruling class, and whatever it takes to get there is completely morally justified. So it's not even that I feel bad doing this, but it's something that we have to do. For example, Golda Meir is famous for saying about the Israeli army, we can forgive the Arabs for murdering our sons, or we can never forgive the Arabs for making our sons into murderers. that says we hate what we're doing right now. We hate that we have to take up arms and kill people. And we can never forgive you for making us do that, because this is all bad. That's an Israeli defense force. That's the opposite of, if you're moving society forward and you have no moral bearings, because man is the pinnacle of all of existence and man's self-consciousness is what rules and governs the behavior of man, so then there's nothing morally wrong with whatever you need to do to push the revolution forward. Stalin is going to kill 18 million of his own citizens. 18 million of his own citizens. And the movement never says that it doesn't fit. He was ruthless. But it's based on a principle that says moving society forward is not a problem. Therefore, listen to, these are Marx's words himself in the box. We therefore reject every attempt to impose on us any moral dogma whatsoever. That moral dogma should be as an eternal, ultimate, and forever immutable moral law. What does that sound like? That sounds like Judaism, right? We have moral dogma that says it's eternal, it's ultimate, it's forever immutable. And why do they reject it on the pretext that the moral world too has its permanent principle to transcend history? We don't say that way at all, says Marx. We maintain, on the contrary, that all former moral theories are the product, in the last analysis, of the economic stage which society had reached at that particular epoch. Meaning, at any given point in history, look at that society and their laws. In the 1400s, they said it was okay to behead somebody, but not okay to chop off their arms. I'm just making something up, because that's torture. That was their morality based on the economic stage that the world was up to at that point. But that doesn't hold true for the next generation, because in the next economic stage, there'll be a different set of moral laws, which are just as subjective. There's no eternal truth to it. It's completely subjective, and it changes. And therefore, we reject in principle, says Marx, the concept of an immutable, permanent, eternal code that says this is right and this is wrong. Now, there couldn't be anything more opposite than what we learn and believe in the concept of, what does it mean that the Torah is divine? It means that the morality and the moral code contained therein is eternal, immutable, unchanging, permanent, the best process for the human being to live always. Now, we struggle with this. Just as an example, I'm going to touch a really hot button, but I'm just going to use it as an example. Just as an example. Homosexuality. 60 years ago, I wasn't in school 6 years ago. When I was in my graduate training in Georgia State, so they used to always talk about, this was their famous subject to talk about, that 60 years ago, in the DSM, in the book of all mental illness, so homosexuality was listed as a mental illness. And they would talk about how now, in whatever it was, the early 2000s, how society has progressed, and now it's celebrated. And I was already a rabbi at the time, was always the next point of discussion that would turn to me, because then I didn't fit that mold, because I'm espousing a belief that says, I don't know, I'm sorry, it says that it's a forbidden act in our code of law, in our Torah, and that's the way that it's always going to be. And it was always a clash, because society's changed, and moral tenets change, and what's considered appropriate behavior changes, and appropriate methods of dress, behavior, all sorts of things. And we have this permanent, fixed set of laws that say, I know, but this is divine. So I know that societies change, and ways of looking at things change, and we have to deal with all of that, but this is what's morally right and what's morally wrong, and it's my moorings, my bearings. I can't budge from that as far as what's right and what's wrong, no matter what I'm in. So Marx held that the world, as exactly what's happened in America, that's the progression of the world. And the moral code that's imposed upon every society's adherence is because that's what society's up to. And societies change and move and progress, and that's normal. But there's no such thing as a set rule that says stealing is wrong, killing is bad, and all of the moral codes that we have that are just, they just are. They're permanent without any place to go within morality. The early Marxists were anarchists. An anarchist believed that in anarchy, because since there shouldn't be government, government is bad, it shouldn't be anyone ruling over anybody else, it should be the people ruling themselves. So they believed in killing off all elements of government, just get rid of them. And they did. That's what anarchists did from 1870 to 1900. They assassinated hundreds of officials throughout Europe. They used to like throwing bombs into their carriages. It was a favorite method of theirs. But it was all fine. There was nothing wrong with that because every governor, every official you take out is one step closer to getting rid of the concept of government. Whereas in Judaism, moral behavior is the essence of everything that we do. The pasuk in Vayikra, we'll read this in a few weeks. You shall not commit a perversion of justice. You shall not favor the poor, and you shall not honor the great. With righteousness shall you judge your fellow. The brackets are the interpretations of how we put it into our context. The Torah is saying, not the poor, not the wealthy, doesn't matter. You judge with righteousness. Whether or not you think the poor is the worker who is exploited, whether or not you think... When they come before you in judgment, doesn't make a difference. Who's right? Who's wrong? Who's been wronged? And who needs to be repaid? I don't care that you're the... The Torah says it's forbidden to say, you know, you're the poor, you're the wealthy. Really, the wealthy is right in this particular case. But you know what? The guy's so poor, I should judge against you because you should pay him $1,000 anyway because you have plenty and he doesn't have anything. You know how to do that. You judge with righteousness. The moral code is permanent and fixed and unchanging. Now, moving on. What about the determinant of man's behavior? So herein lies one of the greatest errors of Marxist philosophy, and that is that Marxist philosophy believes in the intrinsic goodness of mankind, which also sounds nice, except if you read Lord of the Flies, then I guess you know that it's really not. And if you've lived in society, because when there's no law, what Pirkei Avos tells us, always pray for the peaceful government. Why? Because if you don't have peace in your land, says the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, man will swallow his fellow man whole. The language of the ethics of our father, which comes from a verse in the beginning of Bereishis, and right after the story of Cain and Abel, Torah says, "Ki yetzer leiv ha'adam ra minu ura." The inclination of mankind is evil from his youth, and it's our task to perfect ourselves. But that's a task. That's a job that we work on from the moment we come into our own moral understanding, or whatever age that may be, until the day we die, is a task to work, to work, to work, to perfect. It's not a natural thing. On a given a choice, we'd always choose the easy way out, which is not always the right way out. The right way out is often hard. It's easy to be bad, much more difficult to be appropriate. But in Marxist philosophy, what's the determinant of man's behavior? Economics. Economics. Evil acts are the consequences of their position in the class structure of society. And socioeconomic conditions are the responsible for human behavior. If you would remove the oppression from mankind, they wouldn't do evil things. And the socioeconomic place that any particular man inhabits in his particular stage of life is what's driving him to do whatever he's doing. If you could just remove that oppression, if you could remove the exploitation and put all people and make them equal and working together and get rid of that government, they would function in a beautiful social society and they would look out for each other and take care of each other and everything would be lovely and rosy. Torah teaches us that that's nice in theory, but it doesn't actually work out because we have, as I said, it's a struggle to overcome our inclination. A man would prefer to eat each other whole if he could. And therefore, the Torah teaches that the individual, not society, is responsible. In other words, Marx would say, the person's not bad, it's that society is bad to him, and that's why he's behaving poorly. So you got to get rid, you got to change society, overthrow it, have a revolution against it, and therefore allow man to become the good person that he really is. And the Torah teaches us, really, it's the individual. It's not society that's bad. It's the individual who acts in an evil way. It's men who create society. And if it's evil, it's man who's responsible for overcoming that. The first stories in the Torah. You probably have never seen it this way before. Maybe you have, maybe you haven't. First story in the Torah, right? What do we have? What's our first story? Cain and Abel. Good story or bad story? Bad story. Man, right? Man is good or evil in the story? Can you blame society? There is no society. There's no society. There's only Adam. And he's probably pretty good. And yet we have murder. First story in history, and the Torah tells us, you can never blame society for your mistakes. Don't say that it was a culture that you were raised in, that they made it that way, and if you could only change that, you will make those mistakes without society around you. One of the next stories you have is Noach. What do you have in that story? Noach, right? An evil society, and one person who's righteous amongst them. To say, you might also live in an evil society, and you're still not allowed to succumb to those evils, but must rise above that in order to be saved. And the salvation of the Jewish people in world history will come from the salvation from within the evil society. So the two things that Marx would say are, it's society's fault, and that's what needs to be done. The Torah right away says, it's not what we believe. It's the individual and the individual choices that each and every one of us make each and every single day in whatever environment we find us in is really what drives the actions of mankind. And there's no one to blame and no one to say, well, it's because of this and because of that. So how does a person achieve perfection? So for Marx, so since the intrinsic nature of man is goodness, so therefore what needs to happen is a revolution against the existing socioeconomic order. Because if you could only remove that oppression, remove that impediment to mankind's intrinsic goodness, man will become intrinsically good. And therefore everything done towards that means brings the world closer to perfection. Because we need to get rid of that socioeconomic order, rebel against it, have a revolution against it. What we believe, what Judaism believes, is reject the concept of revolution, because the roots of evil and injustice lie not in economics, but in man himself. It's a very different worldview. It's an individualistic worldview that we have. It's within man himself that are the roots. So revolution is not going to help, because if man hasn't fixed himself, who are you going to put in charge after the revolution? The same man who's got the same problems as the people who we are revolutionizing against. Which is what really happened in almost all these revolutions. In all of the communist revolutions, the person who ended up taking charge was far more ruthless, destructive, murderous, than anyone who they tried to depose. Because the problem's not the government or the economics, but the human being. Judaism sets out to perfect the human being. It's not as romantic, it's not as exciting, and it's a much longer process. As mankind trudges through history trying to work on ourselves, trying to perfect ourselves, trying as an entity of the human being, the Jewish people, working our way through history, reaching that point. But that's the only way to do it, through the individual changing himself, not through a revolution against whatever particular government they were in. So it's a system of moral revolution within each individual before the world as a whole can be changed. You know, we're only a month away from Pesach, so we could discuss this in this concept here. There's a concept of freedom, to be able to perfect ourselves. In Marxist thinking, the freedom simply is removing the yoke of someone else's oppression. As soon as you can remove that, then automatically what happens is, given freedom, mankind will flower into the perfect being that he can be. So Judaism is, well, that's partly true. You have to have freedom, but you need something else. And then that's the spiritual freedom, the spiritual work that comes if you have the ability to have that freedom. When we celebrate Pesach, so Pesach passed the story. Pesach gave us the freedom from the oppression of Egypt. But it begins a 7-week process leading up to Shavuos and the giving of the Torah, which is we sing in Dayenu at the Seder. We're not done at the Seder. We're really just beginning. Now that we're not slaves, we have the ability to then work on what the real task in life is, which is our spiritual freedom and development. That's not a natural thing, like, oh, as soon as you remove the shackles of servitude, boom, man becomes perfect. We know that's not true. You need to remove the shackles of servitude so that man has the ability to work on that. But if one doesn't work on that, so given freedom, freedom doesn't naturally produce a great society. Look around the world around us. Just because you live in a free society doesn't make it a morally superior society unless you make it that. So that was one of the next. So as far as ways to achieve perfection goes, Okay, so those are some of the major principles. Again, I'm not even pretending to have really covered what Marxist theory is or how it differentiates and breaks off into socialism and communism, but the ideas of what his revolution was, of freeing the working class from their oppression to create a society that was just and fair, and that everybody would put in what they can and take back what they either need, in terms of creating that socialist environment, this sweeps through the Jewish world, as I mentioned, because the idea of the rebellion against government was certainly one that struck a very ready chord amongst the Jewish people living in Europe at this time. So what happens? We end up with an entire culture now of Jewish socialists. Now the Jewish socialists is joining a movement, again, the socialist movement, the communist movement, Marxist movement, anti-religion. By definition, it has to be anti-religious, because religion, being that opiate, masks and hides, allows a person to say, well, this is God's will, and this is whatever it may be, that we actually think is true, but it hides, in Marxist thinking, from the ability to then progress. But it's the movement that's doing something. The way that Rabbi Wein describes it, the rabbis at the time were obviously powerless to change anything. You're living in a miserable society, wherever you are, in Tsarist Russia, in Western Europe, Eastern Europe. What are the rabbanim going to do to help you? They weren't able to do anything. They couldn't help. They were just as powerless as anybody else. They couldn't fight the Russian government. They couldn't fight poverty. They couldn't fight the quota to send people off to the army. And in that context, but now you have these socialists coming, and they are going to do something. They're actively rebelling, creating a revolution, fighting, changing. So in that context, that was very, very enticing. What was created, many of you familiar with, was known as the Bund in Russia, it spread to Poland and to Lithuania, a Jewish labor union. It was all Jewish, over 450,000 members of the Bund. So if you were a worker in Europe, you would join this, which was a socialist movement. It was anti-religious. The hero of the Jewish people, the one who's going to make all of these changes and create that fair and just society, is this violently anti-religious, anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic person. But the Jews are become part of a movement which doesn't have any Jewish soul to it, but it was the thing to do in terms of affecting any type of change. The entire concept of the Bund, which is a very powerful labor union throughout Europe, was, as I said, anti-Semitic and anti-religious. And that's where the Orthodox, if you wanted to join a workers' union, that's where you joined. So you'd have this funny thing, well, for some Orthodox people who maintain their traditional beliefs, but what it did is the youth, again, gets very much swept up into this very socialist movement, and it brings us, they brought that over to America, as I mentioned a little bit earlier. The early labor unions in the early 1900s were almost all organized and controlled by socialist Jews. Sidney Hillman, who founded and led the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America, David Dubinsky with the National Ladies Garment Workers Union, who were not known as Sidney and David when they were born and raised in Europe, when they were yeshiva students, and they came over. They joined the socialist movement. Both of them, if you look them up on the internet, you'll find their stories. Both of them were yeshiva students from religious families who had aspirations for these very bright young men to follow and become in the rabbinic footsteps of their family, and who were secretly involved in these meetings at the yeshiva and the socialist and communist movement, and joined, and eventually each one of them had different stories as to how they ended up in America, and they became very, very prominent. If you look online, you'll find pictures with these people, both of them, with all of the famous people of the early 1900s in America, all presidents and other significant figures in America in the 1900s, and that was very much the American Jewish scene. It was a very socialist scene. To conclude, the last little section we'll do, there were two major developments which really had an impact on us in the Jewish world out of this movement, which, again, the socialist communist movement, which swept through much of Europe in the early 1900s. Number one was the continued anti-Semitism. So the Jews joined in mass. Hundreds of thousands joined the socialist movement, thinking that they've joined the utopian movement, that there's going to be end of class struggle. This is all about the lower class rebelling against the upper class, against the aristocracy, against bigotry, against all types of anti-Semitism and other things. And they soon discovered that it actually wasn't true. That within the socialist movement, they were not accepted as Jews, and the Jews were still on the outside, and there were still very much anti-Semitic feelings throughout the world. Fast forwarding almost 100 years, anyone who read The Prime Ministers, if you haven't, you should, will recall in the section about Golda Meir. So one of her big revelations, and she was a socialist par excellence, is when she had certain crises, and she would reach out to all of her socialist networks around the world, and she found that as the Jewish socialist running the only Jewish state of Israel, even though she would identify more as a socialist than as a Jew, and the help that she got from her friends was... And that was the disillusionment of, but wait a minute, but I'm a socialist more than I'm a Jew. No, you're still a Jew. That was one of the major revelations as the Jews begin and all the movements happen, the Jews join in, and then the pieces begin to fall, the dust settles, and you look around and you see, okay, now what do we have here? And we have, you're still just as anti-Semitic as you were before, and I still don't belong, even though the tenets of these principles that's guiding us together, the socialist ideal should have made it not that way, but it didn't. The other issue that came was the advent of the Zionist movement, which we're going to talk about at length next week. Rabbi Salman and I are still arm wrestling as to who is going to teach the class next week, post-Purim. On the origins of Zionism. But during this time that we're studying, the late 1800s, early 1900s, is when the Zionist movement begins in earnest, and the Jews begin coming back. Herzl is espousing all of his ideas in this time, and they're all coming from the socialist movement. But what happened is, the socialist movement, who are now not accepting the Jews, and a Jew who expressed any Zionistic fervor, also found no place in any socialist movement, because to be a socialist, you couldn't have a national identity, a national history, a national people, a national book, a national culture. All the things that are so Jewish to us, that are the essence of who we are, couldn't be, doesn't fit. And so as Zionistic fervor is going to spread, It didn't find a home. The same people who were expressing both of these two ideas, who were swept up in the communist socialist movement and in the Zionist movement, but the two clashed. And the socialist movement didn't allow for it. Didn't allow for talk about a homeland. Didn't allow for talk about a national history. We've been in exile for 2,000 years and we're going to go home. You can't talk that way and be a socialist. So what happened is that the Jewish socialist sort of shifted out of the mainstream socialist movement into a Zionist movement, which became and was founded by this disenfranchised socialist, young, passionate Jewish movement, and the two married each other. And the Zionist movement became very socialistic, and when they founded the land, they founded the modern state of Israel, was very, very, it was, we're going to create the perfect Jewish utopia. We're going to take all of those principles that we got from our socialist movement, and we're just going to make it Jewish, and create that utopia in the land of Israel for the Jews. And if you look at what happened, again, we'll discuss this a little bit more next week, that is literally what took place with the early Zionist settlers. What did they bring with them to the land of Israel? I don't know, last little line we have. They brought the concept of the kibbutz. The kibbutz was the banner of the new settlement in Eretz Yisrael, which was, of course, a perfect socialist concept, and it was actually successful for a time. It worked. They did it. They created the perfect utopia for Jews in the land of Israel, combining the Zionistic fervor of the return to the land together with the socialist ideals that had swept through the country. They also brought with them atheist ideals. Because part of the socialist movement is you can't have a God or a divine being. So together with the passion to settle the land, they also brought very anti-religious sentiment, a hatred of religion. They brought a very negative attitude towards capital and money. It was not part of the original settlement. And today Israel is suffering from this greatly as they're shifting from what was at its core, at its heart and soul, a socialist movement, And like the socialist movement all around the world, the next generation and the generation after that does not maintain itself and it turns capitalist. And now that's what's going on literally today in Eretz Yisrael. There's almost no kibbutz left. There are a handful that do not have a capitalist component to it. But that is the shift that's taking place in the whole country, but was founded on the power of the worker, the centrally controlled economy run by government. The Americans who moved to Eretz Yisrael suffer and struggle so much with the way the government is set up because it's so not like the capitalist approach that we have here in America, because it was founded upon those who were passionately socialist in nature, which means it's going to be controlled by the people and it's going to be a government central form of government, and it's socialist, and it was a combination of lots of other things. The concept of hard work and agriculture was very socialist as well. Building the new Jew, it also allowed for the possibility of violence against Britain. You know, there's a part of our history which we don't like to talk about a lot, which was the fact that the Jewish socialists, Zionists, in the early part of the 1900s waged a guerrilla warfare against the British occupiers who were there. If you scale back and say, like, was that right? Was that Jewish? Is that how we go about it? There's a lot of room for debate in that discussion. Not so simple. Where did it start? And then there's the tit for tat, and you kill some of our soil, we're going to kill some of them. The concept of violence is justifiable as far as moving society forward got mixed into this marriage of Zionism together with socialism to return to the homeland. There was this element of violence. Now, there are different parties, which is also going to be one of our classes. We'll talk about the differences between the Haganah and the Irgun and their different approaches. This is all part of it because there was a culture that existed which was born out of these the early socialist movements. Rabbi Wein talks about in the 1930s when Britain was still in control and they would hand out, there was a quota of how many people were allowed to move into the land, and they handed it off to the Jewish agency. They were the ones who decided who came and who didn't come. Now, 1936, before Hitler had totally shifted the way the world looked at the land of Palestine at the time, where no one saw it as a life and death issue, so the Jewish agency literally had control over who was coming in and who was not coming in. If you tried to move to the land of Israel in the 1930s, Rabbi Wein quoted, he read from the minutes of the Jewish agency meetings as they were deciding, you know, they would get, you know, 50 applicants and they had 5 visas that they can give out. So if you were a German Jew and anti-socialist, or you were a yeshiva bachar and you're anti-socialist, you're going to have a hard time getting to the land of Israel because there were very few spots and the people in control were building a world. They were building a socialist world. And if you listen to the lecture, it's like reading off the minutes of, we don't want these Jews here because they don't fit working towards the type of world that we're trying to create here. Now, they didn't see it as life and death, so we're not sitting here to judge. Just to bring out a point that the early state was founded in that realm, and we have remnants of it today, and that's what the land is going through, this shift. The generations of Israelis born now are not socialists. They don't see the world that way. It's 50, 60, 70 years later. Their grandparents were, but the world has shifted, and now you have a non-socialist class of people being raised in what was set up as a very socialist environment, and a lot of the problems that we still have today are based on that. Well, that's understanding the origins are helpful to understanding what it is that's taking place, and we'll see what goes on. Even just to conclude with one more thing in terms of literally current events, to those who are following what's going on with the Israeli army right now, you have to put it in the context as well, in as much as the secular government and world in Israel today are descended from the socialists of Europe who came over. The religious world are descended from those who fought the Tsarist army drafting their children into the army because it was a life and death issue. And you're almost watching play out today, just 100 years later, even though the world has changed, but what's taking place is very similar, in which the religious community views being drafted literally as a life and death issue that's going to destroy all that they've been trying to teach their children, and are viewing it as if it's still that same battlefront that was. And not here, I'm not taking sides, I'm not judging, I'm not saying anything. I'm just saying that the two sides are they're you have to understand history to sort of understand what's playing out. And the leaders of the religious world see in the army remnants of what was truly in the army in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, when the army got started in the 40s. It was to create a socialist world. It's a different world, but there's still remnants of that, and they still see it that way. And the battle is an ideological battle because of it's all these underpinnings. If you take the time to read the religious response as to why they're so opposed to fighting in the army, you will hear them say these words: the army is about creating a socialist, anti-religious culture, and we will not expose our children to that. It's not a discussion about fair share and fighting. It's about that army is a mechanism for creating a socialist society that's anti-religious, and we won't take part in it. That's literally what they say. I could give you articles that describe that. And that was true in the 1940s. It was. That's what the army did. It was there to mesh everybody together and create that society. What is today? I don't live there, so I don't have an opinion. But I could just tell you that the arguments literally that are being made today are throwbacks to the way that it was set up and what comes out of socialist, czarist Russia. They fought against that and set up their own socialist society in the land of Israel, and we're like playing out history as it goes. And, you know, 100 years from now, they'll have a history class describing, you know, what's taking place today as another footnote in this story which is taking place. But we'll continue, Mirtz Hashem, next week, focused on the land of Israel and the return to the land of Israel, the Zionists and the anti-Zionists, and how that played itself out. Those who felt it was time to go back and those who felt you're not allowed to go back, and all of the tension and controversy that was created through that. I wish you all a wonderful night.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.